I'm Ernie Ray and this is the Beyond Belief podcast. Today we're discussing the power of chanting. It's a central part of Buddhist meditation. For centuries, plain chant was at the core of Christian worship. And today, it's on trend. Pop stars are using it on their latest releases. And some research suggests that regular chanting can reduce stress and increase well-being. With me are the Buddhist practitioner and academic Sarah Shaw, the Christian academic historian Christopher Page, and the neurologist Michael Trimble. I began by asking Sarah why she is so keen on chanting.
I just love it. I loved listening to the Hare Krishna chants when I was a teenager. They were very popular. And it just has always attracted me in association with meditation. We have ruminating minds. Just allowing the mind to wash itself in a chant is just a very nice way of starting the day.
Christopher.
It seems to me the chant that I really love, which is the chant that developed in the Middle Ages, I mean, Gregorian chant, everyone's heard of it, really is the root of our Western musical tradition. It's inside all of us. Its wisdom about how long a phrase should last, when you should breathe, shapes our musical sensibility. So in fact, I think it's inside all of us all the time, the chant that really matters to me.
Michael, I gather you're not a practitioner.
Correct.
Why not?
Oh, I think I'm not a very good singer. Of course, I enjoy music enormously, but I think chanting has never been something I've ever done, except perhaps at school at football games.
Michael, has the human voice always been an instrument?
Certainly for vocalisation and for singing, and of course, apart from birds and maybe one or two other primates, which is quite rare, the humans are really the only people who sing and who entrain to music and who get emotionally moved to music. And it seems reasonable to suggest that singing emerged, or some kind of singing anyway, well before the propositional language which we use on a day-to-day basis emerged in terms of evolutionary history.
And what was the purpose of that singing?
Well, that's highly controversial. Darwin couldn't see any purpose in it, which was slightly unusual, I think. But the current ideas would suggest that some kind of musical, emotional intonation very early on in the development of Homo sapiens has an emotional impact on binding people together and group survival, but also promoting other aspects of what happens around a campfire, including eating, but then maybe moving to a rhythm, dancing, and of course then it leads on to some sexual interaction as well. So I think sexual interaction and sexual selection may well have come into our early love of musical intonation and expression.
I found that account extremely interesting, but it didn't mention, I'm sure judiciously so, the importance of vocal melody in worship and the way in which, you know, when we speak all the time, I take it, or so I assume, that because, for example, now my vocal folds are vibrating, there is pitch all the time, but it's so undulating that you don't have a sensation of melody. If I were to stereotype those frequencies into a scale and start to sing, don't you think one would immediately become aware that something was happening? That seems to me to be very fascinating, what it is that does happen. One of my favourite illustrations is, if you were walking down a very narrow path and someone nudged you aside and said, "Get out of the way," you'd be very offended. If that person bumped into you and sang, "Get out of the way," you would not be offended in the same way. And the question is, why is it different? And it seems to me that once you organise the voice into a series of stepped pitches, you immediately become aware that something else is happening. And I think perhaps one of those something else's is the invocation of the divine.
That's, of course, very relevant, but I think I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of years before the time period you're talking about.
Can I come to you, Sarah? Because the earliest known tradition that I know of is the Hindu Vedic tradition, which was in Sanskrit, where there was a lot of
Vedic
chanting.
Yeah.
We do know that at one point it was the preserve of the Brahmins in the Hindu tradition.
Yes, in the Hindu tradition.
And they passed on that information to their sons, always through the mail, I think. But it was text-related.
Right.
It was tied to a text.
To a certain extent. The reason I'm being a little bit hesitant about that is because there is also a sense of oral transmission involving mantras and syllables, which would be passed on and in all the Indic traditions, from the teacher to the pupil. And this, sometimes these sort of seed syllables would be very important and associated with initiations when you started doing them. So we tend to assume text is the earliest form, but we really don't know that. And certainly a lot of the Upanishadic theories say that there was the universe started with a sound, and that this is there is some kind of innate harmony in the universe. And when our very ancient ancestors tried to enunciate, chant or sing, and I think there is a difference between the two, but when they tried to do both of these things, maybe they were just trying to sense something bigger.
Christopher?
What I'd be fascinated to hear about also is just how much we actually know about, for example, Vedic chant, because the kind of crusade that I would wage in favour of, for example, the Latin plain song of the Middle Ages, Gregorian chant, is that thanks to that wonderful invention of staff notation that everybody now still uses, which is essentially, I suppose you could say, a kind of graph, we do have access to the music people were singing up to a point 1,000 years ago in the Western tradition. I mean, we have a pretty good idea. With the Vedic material, for example, I mean, how much do we actually know? A great deal we can reconstruct and feel, but how much do we know?
I think we can know in the sense that we can ever know from layers of language and the way the texts have been preserved for so long. In terms of chanting traditions, there are very well-established procedures. There are a number of different chanting traditions. There are familial lines. You would be, as a young Brahmin boy, you would take an initiation when you first started learning to chant. You would then learn from your teacher. There were various kinds of pitch arrangements. And to this day, a lot of the Brahmin communities use these hand gestures to denote pitch, which I think is still used in some Gaelic Christian chanting as well.
There was a distinction between Hindu chanting and Buddhist chanting in the sense that Hindu chanting was the preserve of the Hindu class, the Brahmin class, whereas Buddhist chanting was open to all. And I think it's time, Sarah, that we had a little demonstration of what chanting sounded like, and I know you're going to give us a little taster.
This is the last extract of the Metta Sutta. This is the Sutta Loving Kindness for All Beings, and it's a meditation. It's a ceremonial text. It's a very communal text. Everybody will chant it, and it's wishing goodwill around. Etang Sating Aditya Brahma Metang Viharang Idamahu De Tinchab Anupagamma Silawa Dasanena sambanno kamesu ineya gedang nahi jatu kabbasayang punaretiti.
Christopher, your fascination with plain chant, do you see any parallels between plain chant and what you've just heard?
Yes, there's a great deal of time is spent in the medieval mass and office just reciting on a monotone in principio erat verbum et Dominus, and so on. That's one of the most fundamental ways in which quite long passages of text are delivered in medieval rites, and it's really quite similar, that idea of what that particular tone that almost burrows into your imagination and into your feeling. Yes, many parallels.
And there is another parallel, because it is about the transmission of text. And in the Middle Ages, the text was set. You weren't expected to diverge from that text because you were transmitting orthodox belief and practice.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, what happens in the liturgy is that the singers are often singing chopped up bits of the Bible, often put together in a new kaleidoscopic sort of way, which is one of the reasons why I think it's important to say that, there's always been some kind of a tension between those who do the chanting in the Christian tradition and those who are, as it were, the equivalent of the Brahmins, the higher clergy, for example. There's been a conflict, I think, a long history of conflict, in which those who are priests and bishops and archbishops wonder quite why you have to have this group of people who are often very junior, unlike the Brahmins, and are often present all kinds of disciplinary problems, they're always getting drunk and so on. I mean, why do you have to have them in the stalls singing these chopped up bits of the Bible? And that, I think, is a fascinating comparison. The people who carry this tradition in the medieval and Renaissance tradition up to the Reformation and in places beyond, they're actually quite junior. They don't carry much status at all. They're hired and fired, at a moment's notice.
And Michael, that led, after the Reformation, to the idea that you could have congregations joining in, that singing and chanting was actually a community event.
Yes, and this must have been very, very crucial, because at that point, it seems that the idea of emotional expression to music, and I'm particularly interested in, for example, crying to music, as Homo sapiens developed, crying to music is really very, very fundamental in terms of crying to the arts. People don't really cry so much to other arts as they do for music.
Christopher?
Crying is one of the most frequently attested reactions of medieval singers to plainsong that we really read about time and time again, and it clearly was very, very common.
Sarah, is that sort of emotion common as a response to Buddhist chanting?
It is, and people cry with joy, and it's one of the manifestations of joy, crying. And I think in Asian culture, to a certain extent, this continues. It's one cries with joy as well as with pain, and maybe tears are sometimes a way of changing both of them into something else.
I think that's an important point, that the tears that we have on record in the Middle Ages are, of course, they're penitential tears, but they are tears in which the soul almost dissolves in joy at the beauty of Christ's sacrifice and the redemption. Absolutely, yes.
Michael?
It seems to me that the monastic worship, if you like, was something exterior. But it seems that I'm understanding that the activities of the Buddhist and maybe the Hindu chanting has to do with the evolution of individual consciousness, a change within the person, as opposed to seeking a deity. And is there any kind of ultimate deistic expression that emerges when you have the great ecstasy of the states you're describing?
Sarah?
Well, there's mindfulness is inside, internal, mindfulness is external, and it's both external and internal. That's one Buddhist formulation. And it's both communal and solitary, both at the same time.
But Michael's point is that in Christian chanting, you are chanting as an element of worship to an external deity. In Buddhist chanting, it's an internalized thing.
I wouldn't like to be dogmatic about that in either case, actually. There is a sense of worship in Buddhist chant. And again, the differentiation between the inside and the outside is not always so clear. Does that sort of answer the question?
Michael?
Well, not entirely. I mean, it seems that the chanting is to do with altering states of consciousness.
No, not necessarily. I mean, it does it as a byproduct. It's very nice when it happens. Most chanting is to establish senses of community, to arouse joy, to purify somewhere. There are all sorts of different functions of chanting, as I think there were in the Christian tradition. It is lay as well as monastic. But I think this word internal is one that I would like to interrogate a little, because I feel it's not quite appropriate for either Christianity or Buddhism. But certainly in Buddhism, we're doing it for a number of reasons, one of which is our own well-being.
Christopher, is there a distinction between singing and chanting? And if there is, how would you define it?
To be honest, it's not a distinction I would make or find it in the material that moves me, really. I would have a great deal of use for, unless I were going to say that when you intone on a single pitch, for example, as we heard earlier from Sarah, with a little inflection, that's chanting as opposed to a more melodic form of music that you might wish to call singing.
Michael, do they have different effects on the brain, singing and chanting?
Well, I think this is quite fascinating because, as far as I can see, much of what we do with singing relates to breathing. A very brief diversion, I talked about entrainment, but there's an internal entrainment that our heart rate and our breathing is entrained, so that if your heart rate alters, breathing alters, etc. So that's internal entrainment. But we know that we can entrain to music, to a musical beat, so that you hear a beat within the music, and it's possible that your heart and breathing rate entrains to the external beat. And it seems to me that whatever is the semantic content, if you like, of what is being chanted, it is coordinated respiratory activity, particularly the breathing linked with the heart rate, that is a common underlying factor. And so if you go to sessions where people try to suggest relaxation and whatever, it's always breathing which people pay attention to. And this has to do with the autonomic nervous system, the nervous system which is the bit that keeps us going from moment to moment in terms of heart rate and sweating and breathing, etc. It's the breathing which underlies so much of singing activity, but also entrainment to the external people you're with. So if you're in a choir, there have been studies showing that when choirs are singing together, the singers within the choir also entrain together their heart rate and particularly their breathing.
Can I say that seems to me to be absolutely fundamental? I mean, if you sing medieval plainsong in a choral way, you're singing all the same. Everyone is singing the same melody, so everyone breathes at the same place. You pause at the same place and you resume at the same place. So a group of people who, I take it, were all breathing at different rates, soon find themselves breathing in a synchronized manner. And the depictions of medieval singers actually singing this kind of music often show them touching one another, a hand on the shoulder, or indeed even sometimes holding hands, as if they're maintaining some sort of physical coherence amongst themselves, some circuit of energy that is flowing between them.
Let me remind you that you're listening to Beyond Belief, and today we're discussing the power of chanting. If we practice chanting on a regular basis, will it improve our physical, mental and spiritual well-being? Can it change the way we live our lives? And with me are Michael Trimble, Christopher Page and Sarah Shaw. Belinda Carlisle is absolutely convinced of the power of chanting. She was pop royalty in the 70s and 80s with hits like Heaven is a Place on Earth, and she freely admits that she succumbed to many of the pitfalls that strew the path to pop stardom. But she has changed.
When I turned age 40, I was doing a lot of soul searching. I'd always been defined by what I do, and I had been dropped by my record company. And I discovered an organization called Soka Gakkai, which supports Nichiren Buddhists around the world, and it's Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, along with morning and evening recitations. But all along, for the past 26 years, I've also been involved with Kundalini Yoga. And those mantras are taken from the Sikh tradition. And I know that they are powerful. When I got sober almost 13 years ago, I was chanting 2 and 3 hours a day. It's not airy-fairy, it's a science. And it has all sorts of benefits, actually.
Now, apart from getting you sober, what other benefits has chanting brought you?
Well, when you chant, you activate the 84 meridian points on the roof of your mouth. So that's a scientific part. So it not only activates your glandular system, which gives you optimum health, it does heighten your intuition, which and your connection to something that's bigger than yourself. And I think the most important thing that it's done for me, and I have a really, you know, strong practice. I chant every day. It's made me realize that the world isn't outside, it's within yourself. And that's a really powerful thing to realize.
Are the words important, the words that you chant?
I always like to know the translation of what I'm chanting. And I think with my album, Wilder Shores, 7 of the mantras are in Gurmukhi, which is ancient Sanskrit. It's called the language of the gurus. And I chose things that have been really effective for myself. They all have meanings. For instance, I chose some really simple ones, like Hami Ham Brahm Ham, which is, you know, I am God, God is in me. And Ekankar Sat Guru Prasad, which is called the miracle mantra.
Ekankar Sat Guru Prasad, Sat Guru Prasad.
And if you need sort of a quick fix of like a pick-me-up and want to elevate the mood, that's a really good mantra. They all have different themes. They mean a lot to me.
When you came to work out what you were going to put into Wilder Shores, did you find it easy to combine the chants with the pop music?
No, not at all, actually. What I do is I'm a pop singer. I knew that in that genre, there's a certain format. But I thought, well, this is going to be non-traditional. Maybe some people will get it. Maybe some won't. But there's no reason why repetitive mantra can't be put into a pop song format. You know, verse, bridge, chorus, maybe middle eight. And that's exactly what was done. And I don't write music, and that's probably really helpful for something like this, is I just sang the mantras with a tune in my head into my iPhone, and would take him into the studio, and my songwriting partner, Gabe Lopez, and I work really intuitively. So he really understood what I was looking for. So it was very, very easy, actually, once we knew that it could be done after we finished the first mantra.
Pop music is a highly strung business, and I think in the past you've admitted that you're quite highly strung yourself. Is that part of the appeal of chants and mantras, calming you down?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's no question about that. I think it almost puts you into a rhythm of something that's greater than yourself, of a greater consciousness. And that in turn sort of calms you down. I do know that I have that tendency, and I always have, and I know that it's been very helpful.
If you had to define one aim for your album, what would it be?
The one thing that I was hoping that this album would accomplish is that it would help people, and that I would be able to turn on people that would never normally even think about chanting to something that's been really helpful in my life. And especially with the world in the state that it's in right now, it's a really effective tool.
That was Belinda Carlisle. Sarah, what did you make of that?
I liked what she said very much. We all ruminate and go over things in our mind, and she seems to understand something about the power of chants of different kinds to just change our feelings and our state of mind in a meditative sense, really. And I liked what she said very much.
Michael, it clearly worked for her.
Yes, it did, but she brought in the deity as an important part of some of the experiences that she had. And again, referred to the alteration of consciousness in some way, which again was what I was kind of sort of hinting at, that it's some perspective of altering or getting a deeper sense of consciousness. And now whether that's specific to what we're talking about or not, I don't know. I mean, I think that a number of people would say, well, they take LSD or they take some cannabis or something, and that leads to an altered state of consciousness.
But I think you're absolutely right, but she has control, and that's the real difference between the chanting and the drugs. She has the control.
Yes.
She's bringing... I think what she says is so accurate. She's changing her state of mind, and she's deriving strength from it. It's not destroying her as drugs do.
Christopher, what did you make of it?
It seemed to me she was just behaving like a musician. I mean, she'd been inspired by certain ideas, she'd created certain core sounds associated with text, and she went into the studio, you know, like the Beatles doing Sgt. Pepper, and she made something out of it. I mean, that's what musicians do. Her own description of what she's doing is something, of course, she's perfectly entitled to. I mean, a lot of what she's describing is very, very familiar activity for creative musicians, indeed for composers, and that's how I see her, not as a mystic.
And also a meditator's mind. I think most meditators would recognise something in what she describes.
Michael, we know that it has short-term effects. It slows the heartbeat. Are there any signs, any evidence that it can have a long-term positive effect on a person's well-being?
We're talking about singing or we're talking about the chanting?
I think we're talking about both.
Yes, and the answer is probably not. It's very difficult to do experiments. So if you wanted to do some experiments, let's say, with Buddhist monks... You know, how many forms of Buddhist traditions are there, and how many different forms of chanting activity? It's extremely difficult. So you can do more with Western-style music. Now, I suppose the classic example of where you can't do something is the Mozart effect. I'm sure most people have heard that if you listen to Mozart's 448, you will become more intelligent. And this was extremely popular at one time, playing Mozart to babies. Of course, you can show an effect of music on, let's say, some IQ function, intelligent function. But it lasts while the music's there. But the evidence that it lasts longer is rather different. And I think that what we heard is a sort of a self-healing process through coming off the drugs and finding some alternative activity of escaping from the drugs, which is very plausible.
Christopher, just talk a little bit about choral evensong, because one of the phenomena of the present day, when church attendance overall is declining like mad, is that cathedral worship, with all its glory, with wonderful music in a wonderful environment, is actually increasing in popularity. And I wonder, is that in some way a response to the increasing stressfulness of life in today's world?
Well, I think that it could well be. There must be a reason, for example, why one or two CDs of Gregorian chant have gone platinum and have sold fantastically well. And I imagine that is for just the reasons you say, that people find the music lulling and spiritual, and that it answers to a hunger in themselves, or what Philip Larkin calls the desire to always be somehow more serious than one is in life most of the time. But, I mean, even a song is a very beautiful service. I mean, the idea of celebrating the end of the day with lights and with chant, or with song, congregational song it may be, that represents a kind of distillation of what was the medieval Vespers service. But the congregational act of singing is something that people have come to see the meaning of more and more.
I want to ask each one of you a final question as we draw this programme to a close. Assume I'm a sceptic, Sarah, and I'd like you to persuade me in one or two sentences of why I should take up chanting.
I don't think anybody should take up chanting. I think it's something you do because you like it. It's the word paritta for blessings in Buddhist chanting, it means to rescue or to recover. It is a kind of self-healing process. If you like it, you like it, but I wouldn't want to make you do it if you don't want to.
So, Christopher, in one or two sentences, why should I listen to Gregorian chant?
Because the music is deeply beautiful and spiritual, and in the most simple way, relaxing. Because it speaks to a deep wisdom about the way the voice works, where breath is needed, how you bring a melody to a close, how you signal that it's not yet quite over, because it is wise.
And Michael, as a scientist, why should I listen carefully and appreciatively to singing and chanting?
Because it does affect the aspects of your central nervous system that relate to not only keeping our body intact and in coordination with the immediate environment, but also relates very much to our emotions. And we have to have ways of relaxing and being relieved from intense emotions. And one of the ways through that is through music. And I love the word wisdom. Music is wise, and music brings you knowledge, but it's not the knowledge that philosophers want to get out with their insistence on words.
Well, there we must leave it. My thanks to Christopher Page, Michael Trimble and Sarah Shaw. I'll be back again at the same time next Monday. Do join me.